This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Louis Armstrong is a massive figure in American music history. His vocal and instrumental innovations profoundly influenced American music in the 20th century. A new book, Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism, documents his life in the 1920s and 30s after his journey north from New Orleans. Thomas Brothers is a professor of music at Duke University and the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism, and he joins us in our studio now. Tom, welcome. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, this book takes us north to his life, nightlife in the clubs, and the time where he really stamped his image on American music, but we do have to go back a little bit, right? Because, listen, there's a great story about Louis Armstrong gets sent to reform school, juvenile detention, because one night he's kind of whooping it up on New Year's Eve, lets off a gun, he goes to juvie. No? Not true?
Well, it was true in the public imagination. There was probably a lot more to it than that. He lived in a fairly unsupervised situation, and it was apparently not his first trip to the courtroom on that New Year's Eve celebration night. So, yeah.
Tell us about his beginnings, though, and that life in New Orleans.
He was surrounded by music, I would put it that way, and he was immersed in what I call the African-American musical vernacular, the music made by everyday people for themselves daily, with nothing special, just the common tongue of music, actually. So, and as that expressed itself in church, on the streets, in parades, of course, New Orleans famous for parades, in blues especially. And so it was from that point of view, he was impoverished and deprived from some points of view, but tremendously enriched from a musical point of view and from a social point of view, too, I would say. There was tremendous agreement in his community about the importance of this music. And so he grew up with that, I think.
And mentored by the great King Oliver.
That's right. He was lucky when he got out of the home. He was spent about 18 months in the home. He stumbled into the lap of Joe Oliver, who was not crowned king yet, but would be in Chicago. And Oliver basically recognized himself a little bit in Armstrong. Oliver had grown up immersed in church music, immersed in that kind of thing, and made his career bringing blues and church music to professional dance music. That's really what makes New Orleans special, is bringing those things into a kind of dance music. And that's so Armstrong learned that and actually had lessons with Oliver.
And that dance music makes its way north, Oliver and Louis Armstrong himself. Talk about that period, 1922 to 32. First, Armstrong's decision to leave New Orleans, go to Chicago.
Right. So we're talking about the Great Migration. We're talking about the first phase of the Great Migration, a massive movement of people from the South, from the rural South and from the urban South, approximately 50,000 people moving to the South Side of Chicago during the decade of the 1915 to 19, to the late 1920s, basically. So these musicians from New Orleans find their place on the South Side of Chicago providing music for these people, and is tremendously successful. So Armstrong is really late in the game from that point of view. He's a little younger than some of the other musicians, but he was also reluctant to leave. He was doing well in New Orleans and establishing a place for himself. He's kind of a homeboy. He is a little nervous about leaving the city. He had never done that, really. And so Oliver was the one who got him to leave in 1922. Oliver asked him to come and play second cornet in his band. And that's basically what Armstrong did. He went to Chicago and played in Oliver's bands for nearly 2 years.
Talk about the clubs and the club life in the South Side of Chicago. Are these mainly African-American audiences initially?
Well, this place where he steps in 1922 through 1924 is Lincoln Gardens, it's called, and the name itself indicates what kind of demographics it has. This is a totally African-American venue. Now, when we say totally African-American, that doesn't mean that there was never a single white person there. Whites could integrate any club they wanted to just by walking in the front door. And management was often glad to have them because if you could encourage a white patronage base, you could raise the rates. But these places that Armstrong made his name at, the Lincoln Gardens, the Vendome Theater, the Savoy Ballroom, these are, I would say, exclusively African-American in the sense of over 99% African-American audiences.
Yes. Let's take a listen to the music that helped make his name. This is a clip of the West End Blues recorded in 1928. Armstrong, recording of West End Blues, 1928, and Tom Brothers is here, the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. Tell us about where is Louis Armstrong now in his career? Has he created the innovations that will later make him famous?
Yes. By 1928, he has done quite a bit, actually. So from 1922, when he's kind of a shy person, not really willing to step out into the spotlight, until 1928, he has basically revolutionized jazz. I call the book Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. That was a phrase that one of his marketing agents used in 1930. And I don't think anybody challenged that because his music had a real radical nature to it. It had something that was both identifiably black and sophisticated enough to rival white music. This was the sort of magical combination for him.
He would eventually become one of the most successful. In fact, he would have one of the top-selling records in the country, right? White and black.
By 1932, he had crashed the white market. Now, so 1928, this is the Savoy Ballroom. West End Blues, we know, was performed in June of 1928 when this was recorded. We know it was performed at the Savoy Ballroom, which is holds 6,000 people. By 1932, he had entered the white market, and a lot had happened during those years, too. But yes, in 1932, he was the best-selling maker of records in the country. So he sold more records than anyone else of any kind of music, actually.
This had to be remarkable at that time. No African-Americans are certainly doing this.
Certainly not, no.
And he's covered now, particularly in the black press. Chicago Defender is really paying particular attention to his career.
Yes, you know, that was a great boost to this book. I can do keyword searching in all these historically black newspapers, and not just the Chicago Defender, which was the biggest African-American newspaper. It circulated nationally, actually. Yeah, and they tracked his career, absolutely.
Well, they dubbed him, was it the Defender that dubbed him King Menelik?
Yeah, we could probably, play a little bit more from West End Blues, maybe the introduction, which I think is plays into this comment really well. So so this recording is from 1928, June 28, 1928, and just a week later, one of the writers in the Chicago Defender started referring to Armstrong as King Menelik. Now, King Menelik was the Ethiopian king who got rid of the Italians, won a military victory over the Italians, is sort of an anti-colonial movement. And so he became a hero to African-Americans everywhere. A week later, this writer, whose name is Dave Payton, said that Armstrong slayed all the Ofay demons the other night at the Savoy Ballroom. Ofay is black slang for white. So Armstrong is slaying white demons. Why is he slaying white demons? What does this mean? This means, I think, this is my interpretation. First of all, my interpretation is that he's referring to this piece, to the introduction to West End Blues, because that was just played a couple weeks before. But whites were starting to claim supremacy in jazz, actually. That's what was happening around this time. Jazz, when it first started to emerge in the country in 1917, a long time before, was regarded as primitive, as vulgar, not something any you would want to claim ownership of if you were a respected white musical journalist. By 1928, things had changed a lot. Now we've got George Gershwin, we've got Paul Whiteman, we've got all kinds of things, Irving Berlin. These people are making a stamp, making jazz part of their own. And so there's this back and forth about, you know, who's the best in jazz and this kind of thing. And Peyton's saying it's Armstrong. Armstrong can do what no white can do, no white player can do, basically.
You know, rather than listen to that intro, though, there's another example of this, I think, and tell me if this works as well, and that is in his vocals, where he also talked about taking ownership of some of the songs that by then white crooners had been sentimentalizing, and for Louis, there was a whole other approach to those songs. Let's listen to this.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend a lonely night. Baby, oh, I know, dreaming of a song melody in my memory, and I'm once again with you, when the love was new, always, it's just an inspiration, baby, that was long ago, now now my constellation, it's in the stardust of a song. Beside a garden wall, when stars are bright, you walk in my arms, baby, baby. The night is getting down, it's very low. I'm dying in my room, you know. Though I'm dreaming, baby, baby, in my heart.
So tell us about that and that vocal style.
Well, this is a great performance. This is 1931 Stardust, Hoagy Carmichael's famous, famous song, which was known everywhere in the country, of course. And for those of you who know Stardust, you can tell that Armstrong is not exactly giving a straightforward rendition of it. As Rudy Vallee said, now this is the era of the crooner. Rudy Vallee was the most famous of the crooner of the day. Bing Crosby was making a big name for himself as a crooner. These guys gave very sentimental versions of these songs, their emotions on their sleeve, sort of blushing, sort of intimate, sort of soft, almost effeminate. They were accused of being effeminate, actually, from their rivals. Rudy Vallee said that Armstrong treats these songs like a madman would treat them. And Vallee loved Armstrong, actually. He wrote the preface to his first autobiography, Swing That Music, in 1935. So, and someone else says that Armstrong fractures ballads. He splits them into pieces and then reassembles them on his own terms. So, and this is very much what he's doing. He's not, when he delivers the words like that, you can hear him sort of slurring over some of the words. Sometimes he'll just break out into scat. You're never quite sure what his status is, what his relationship is to the song, actually. And it is a complete transformation. As you said, he makes the song his own. That's a very good description of it.
Were people trying to imitate him at the time? You said there are two distinct styles now. Was there a way that we're now beginning to distinguish black music from white music? And there was some money to be made if you were a sentimental crooner, distinguishing yourself over and against that kind of music?
Yes, and yes. people were trying to imitate him from the first, what I call the first modern style, which is basically identified with the Hot Fives. So the Hot Five series is a famous recording series in jazz. And that was the period of the mid-late 20s in Chicago that we're talking about. I call that his first modern style. And yes, white musicians knew about it. If you wanted to be show that you knew what was going on, you listened to Louis Armstrong, and you modeled your style on him. That's how he became the most important soloist in jazz, is by all these musicians imitating him and extending what he was doing.
The move north by no means meant that he was removed from racism. Chicago, of course, as racist a town as any in the South, although expressing itself in new ways. Talk about when the two clubs, the crossover clubs now that are attracting white and black audiences, Plantation and the Sunset, and the relationship with the mob and Al Capone. Mm. This fascinating connection here.
That's true. He wasn't playing for just African-American audiences in the South Side of Chicago. There was a place called the Sunset Cafe, which was known as a black and tan cafe. That place had all black staff, all black musicians, all black entertainers, all black waiters, dancers, everybody. But all white audiences. If you were black, you couldn't get into the Cotton Club in Harlem. There might have been a single exception once a year or something. You know, Bill Bojangles Robinson would be given a table in the back or something like that. But it really pretty exclusively white audiences. So that's what black and tan means there. And the Sunset is not that exclusive. The Sunset has all black staff, but it has an integrated audience. And so part of the thrill of it was that whites could come to this place and experience integration, actually. You could dance if you were a wealthy white man, and these clubs were not cheap to get into. That's why the musicians liked working there, because the tips were good and the pay was good. And yes, he played at the Sunset Cafe for maybe a good 2 years, I think. And some of his important music was generated there.
And Al Capone, a great sponsor of this kind of music.
Yes, these clubs, the Black and Tans especially, were run by the mob. That's quite clear. Different mobs were involved with different clubs. And the musicians got used to that, actually. They got used to it. And in fact, they sort of appreciated it at some level, because the mobsters tended to tip really big. And they tended to take care of their own. If you were with them and if you followed their rules, then, you know, there were a lot of benefits to come from that. So the music business, being precarious business that it is, that had some advantages.
Fascinating story, Thomas. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
Thomas Brothers is a professor of music at Duke University and the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. And as we leave this segment, we will leave you with the music of Louis Armstrong and the West End Blues. Coming up next, the music of Jack the Radio. Stay tuned.